I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the dot-com boom. Remember when people used to toss around chit-chat about venture capital millions the way people used to talk about sports scores or, in D.C., election results? Crazy stock prices, crazy parties. It was all part of the once-staid Washington, D.C. scene. It seemed like it would never end, until it did. We'll talk to two people who were along for the ride in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about another bumpy ride, the career of New York Governor David Paterson. He made history as New York's first black governor. He also sparked pride as the nation's only disabled governor. But his star has dimmed and his approval ratings have plummeted after a series of explosive allegations about his efforts to help and aid through an ugly incident of domestic violence. Meanwhile, three of Paterson's top advisors have quit in the past 2 weeks. The governor is making the case that he is proceeding with the state's business. On Friday, at the grand opening of a restaurant at John F. Kennedy Airport, Paterson told reporters explicitly that he is not going to resign. Today, he holds a town hall meeting in Brooklyn to discuss the state budget and other financial issues. But we wanted to know, can he hold on? And what about his core of support in the African-American community? To talk more about this, we called Joel Dreyfus, managing editor of the online publication TheRoot.com, and Eleanor Tatum, publisher and editor of the Amsterdam News in New York. Both are publications that focus on issues of particular interest to the black community, and they're both with us from New York. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I wanted, if you both don't mind, I wanted to play a couple of clips to just set up the scene for us. There was a meeting of African-American activists and officials last week, and State Senator Eric Adams had this to say about this question of whether Governor Paterson should hold on. Here's what he had to say.
So there's no other reason why anyone else that has never ran for office is still asking the question, can he govern, when those of us who are governing with him are saying, yes, he can govern.
And, of course, David Paterson has the same view. As we mentioned on Friday, he spoke to reporters explicitly about this. This is what he had to say.
These issues are going to affect the people of New York a lot more than my problems. And when I get up here to speak, I'm not creating the distraction. I'm continually trying to talk about that issue, because in June and July, people will remember that this is the issue we have to confront right now. It is the priority.
Of course, he's talking about the budget there and the sort of state of the New York economy overall. So, Eleanor Tatum, do people agree with him and Senator Adams? Do they buy that argument?
I think many in the black community do buy that argument and do think that he can continue to govern. I mean, the fact of the matter is this state has been in trouble for a while now, and Governor Paterson is the only one that's actually made any decisions to try to make sure that the state stays afloat. And the fact of the matter is that the legislature has not been functioning properly itself. And I think the governor is doing his best to make sure that we do get something accomplished.
Do you think he can?
I think he can if people stop focusing on what hasn't actually happened. There have not been any indictments. The investigation has not been completed yet. And if they let him do what he is elected to do, well, that he has been appointed to do because of Spitzer's leaving office, then he will be able to do the work. But if people continue to get in the way by bringing up all these other things that really have nothing to do with the day-to-day operations of the state, it will make it difficult. But is he capable of doing it? Yes.
Joel, what do you think?
I think it's a tough time for the governor, and I doubt that he can get much accomplished. First of all, power is always in the perception. And when you're one, a lame duck, you have a cloud over your head. He wasn't getting the cooperation from the state legislature before these scandals erupted. I just find it hard to believe that he can last out a term or get anything accomplished because, unfortunately, the focus is going to be on his troubles, and that's going to keep, you're going to keep seeing revelations in the papers. Now they've asked the state attorney general to investigate some of the allegations. State attorney general is also a potential candidate for governor, so it raises some interesting conflicts of interest. So I think that it's going to be very tough for him, and I don't see how he can last a year doing this.
One of the other issues, though, mm-hmm. is who else could govern better at this point in time? As you even said, that the legislature has not gotten along very well, and this is something that's been going on for the last several years. But the fact is, can Ravitch do any better? And I don't think the answer is yes.
Richard Ravitch being the lieutenant governor. Eleanor, what is the source of support for the governor right now? Is it the, historically just having an African American in that position? Is just deemed so important that people have to support him despite the fact that he's clearly battered? Is it that his respect for his father, who was, of course, a significant, a huge figure in New York politics? What's the source of regard for him right now?
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, that yes, he has attained a historic position by being the first African American governor. But in addition to that, I think a lot of people think he's gotten a bum rap. And in terms of the way the media coverage has gone after this, and, you know, the fact is that it is under investigation, but there have not been any indictments, there has not been any charges. So people are saying to themselves, well, what is the actual story here? I mean, this whole thing with the New York Times, for weeks there was, quote unquote, a story coming down that was going to ruin the governor. But it took weeks for it to finally come out. And then we find out that it's actually more about one of his aides than the governor himself. And yes, there were talks now about some involvement that he may or may not have had with the incident that took place with his aide. But again,
well, he acknowledges that
we don't know.
But he acknowledged that he called the woman who had accused his very close aide of a very, very disturbing case of domestic violence, that she was seeking a stay-away order and that she didn't show up for court. And he acknowledged that he called her.
Yes.
Why would he call her?
Has the governor actually told us what happened in that conversation? Do you know what actually took place in that conversation and what the purpose of that conversation was? The fact is, we do not know the answer to that. And from what my sources tell me, it was not anything to do with trying to persuade her not to press any charges or anything like that. It had a very different tone.
And it's really hard to have this conversation without noting that Congressman Charlie Rangel, who's the dean of the New York Congressional Delegation, was also forced to step aside from the chairmanship of the Heavyweight House Ways and Means Committee. And Joel, what effect do you think all of that is having on how this issue is being framed and kind of the sense of what David Patterson should do? Do you think that the two of those stories are working together in a way to create a certain impression?
I think that these two stories work together because they indicate what happens, that there's been a shift of power in New York, and in not just in New York, but of course in the country, not only with President Obama, but the fact is that black politicians have acquired unusual power. Charlie Rangel waited 40 years to become chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. New York State, which while it's produced great national champions like Adam Clayton Powell before Rangel, is not a place that's good for black people in terms of politics. There's been a continuing struggle for African Americans to gain any real political power in New York. New York is a state that's, you know, was, you know, predominantly white. It was a New York City was a hotbed of white liberalism, people who professed to be looking out for the interest of African Americans. I think that always holds, it makes it more difficult for African Americans to emerge in their own interests when there are other people professing to represent them. So I think that what you're seeing is a new scrutiny of black politicians as they move into positions of power because it upsets the status quo.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Joel Dreyfus, managing editor of TheRoot.com, and Eleanor Tatum, publisher of The Amsterdam News. We're talking about New York Governor David Patterson's political woes and more broadly the question of black political power in New York. And to that end, Joel, there was an article in Politico this weekend that says that it was written by Ben Smith, who wrote that the sun is setting on Harlem as the seat of New York's black political elite and the symbolic national center of black politics. Do you think that that is true? I mean, and the article goes on to suggest that part of the issue here is that the New York black political elite hasn't done a good job of cultivating a set of successors who can step in when something like this takes place. Do you think that's true?
Well, that's been true for a long time. You know, there are a lot more black people in Brooklyn and have been for the last 30 years than in Manhattan. The fact is that Harlem is I suppose you could call it the symbolic center of black culture, power, politics in New York. But Brooklyn is by far a much bigger borough, much larger black population. And again, Harlem is in a midst of a gentrification process, just as Washington, D.C. has been going through, where the black concentration in New York is, in Harlem in particular, is declining. And so there are a lot of things going on that are And in this, the second thing about political power and the sharing and nurturing of successors, it's always been a problem. In fact, Basil Paterson, many years ago, and I covered him as a young reporter, I said to him, where are the successors of the current generation? And why haven't they brought people, say, of my generation at that time into the process? And he said, man, these guys are terrified of young ambitious black people. So I think it is a self-perpetuating club in New York, in Harlem in particular, for many, many years. I think it's been much more wide open in Brooklyn. And I expect in the future we'll see much more of a black political leadership emerging from Brooklyn.
And I'm going to give you the final word. We have about a minute left. What do you think?
Well, you know, last week in my editorial, I entitled it, "Negroes Who Attain High Office Must Walk Like Angels." And that was from a editorial written in the Amsterdam News in 1967, in January of 1967, talking about what was happening to Adam Clayton Powell. And the fact of the matter is that we have attained high office. And the more people that we get into high office, the more scrutiny is attached to all of them. And quite frankly, I think that there are people that are afraid of having too many blacks in high places.
Like who?
And once we have that, and we have a black president, New York State has a black governor. We had Charlie Rangel, head of Ways and Means, the most powerful committee. And once you have that, people are afraid of that concentration of power. And there are those people out there that would do whatever they can to make sure that that power does not rest in the hands of black people.
Well, to be continued, we'll keep us posted. Eleanor Tatum is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Amsterdam News in New York. Joel Dreyfus is managing editor of the online magazine, TheRoot.com. They were both with us from New York, and we thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, last night was Hollywood's biggest night, the Oscars. We'll give you our take on the big moments, and we'll talk about coming out in Hollywood. Now, you might think it's no big deal. It turns out it is. We'll hear from a public relations specialist who helps celebrities come out in Tinseltown. That's just ahead. But first, remember startups, venture capital, big fancy parties, the dot-com boom? It started in the early 90s in Silicon Valley and also came to Washington, D.C. But then it was over. This week's Washington Post magazine takes a look back. Writer Christina Britta Antonidis told the story through a group of 10 people who saw the bubble inflate and then pop. I'm joined now by two of the people featured in her piece. Here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio is Raul Fernandez. He founded Proxicom, an e-commerce company, which made him, for a time, a billionaire. Now he's the co-owner of three of D.C.'s professional sports teams, the Capitals, the Wizards, and the Mystics. And Shannon Henry, she chronicled the dot-com years as a Washington Post columnist for a decade. She's the author of The Dinner Club about the D.C. area tech boom. She's also the co-founder of the online food site Cooking with Friends, and she's with us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. I welcome you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Raul, I'm going to start with you. In 1999, your company Proxicom went public. Its value quickly shot through the roof. What did the company do? How did you get the idea
for
it?
Sure. It started off making software that was better, faster. The computer industry and the software industry was moving from mainframe computers to client server, and the next step was the internet. So we were really at the beginning of this new way of computing, this way of distributing browsers and having those browsers that could be anywhere tapping into incredible information. So most of our work was business to business.
Well, when you started the company, did you ever envision that you would become a billionaire with a B?
No. The plan was to make some money, grow, have some fun, work hard, be independent, you know, everything that any entrepreneur wants in terms of spending a lot of time, energy, and passion and growing a company. But we walked into a phase where there was brand new, you know, truly transformational technology. I think regardless of the boom and bust, that was a turning point in the way everyone communicated, collaborated, and did everything. And we're seeing it today.
Shannon Henry, you began writing a column for the Washington Post called The Download, and you covered people like Raul Fernandez. What was that like as a journalist? Did you have a sense at the time that something huge was happening?
I did. I felt like Washington, where I had grown up, was really changing. And you started hearing this story that you'd never really heard before in Washington, and obviously it was happening in Silicon Valley and many other pockets around the country, in New York, Boston, Seattle, where people really wanted to change the world. And that was, you know, the good part of the boom, was that it's great to hear somebody talk about an innovation that will change the way we work or think or talk or do things. It became a different world where people in the tech community made more money and sort of were more powerful than some of the politicians, and that was a way it changed Washington. The craziness really came, I think, a lot of people wanted to get into it, like the real estate boom, where they saw a lot of other people making money and thought they should be making that money too.
Well, what about that? I think a lot of what people remember of that period, they remember the pace of change. But a lot of what people outside of the business saw was just the conspicuous consumption. They saw, like, all of a sudden Ferraris on the streets of Washington. That's something that was typical. Big houses going up, crazy parties that, you know, that just sort of happened out of nowhere. Did you remember being a part of that? Was that something you think about now?
Well, there was definitely a culture, and it, you could see it through recruiting, right? So you were going after the best and brightest. And they were looking for the biggest, fastest, next big thing. They, you know, and the incentives became cars, right? So, you know, there was an incentive. Some companies locally were offering actually cars for some of their employees to come over, some key employees to come over. So it did get very crazy for a relatively short period of time. I mean, when you think back, now we've lived through another bubble and another bust that was far more significant than what we had 10 years ago. And so if you step back and you look at the context of the spike and what happened afterwards, the hangover, it was high and it was low, but it was so much smaller than what we just lived through. What we just lived through almost collapsed the whole financial system, not just got some people rich on paper and then they came back down to earth.
But what was it like to be that rich on paper? You're still very well off. I mean, it's not, you know, not to be putting your business out there, but you're still very well off. Anybody who co-owns three sports teams is not hurting. But what was it like to see your net worth, at least on paper,
you know, it was,
go into that many zeros?
It was surreal, and it was never, at least in my mind, taken seriously, because having grown a business and knowing what it was like to create profits, reinvest the cash, you understood what it took to create real wealth. So when all of a sudden you're in the stock market, you know, your stock is up for no reason, you know, over 5 days, 30%, you just step back and say, look, this just can't be real. How long will it last? That was the question mark. But it's a little bit like fantasy sports, except that you're the player and the owner.
Shannon, what about that? What Thoreau has just pointed out to us, that in fact what the country is going through now is more significant economically. It certainly affects a lot more people. But do you think that the internet sort of boom and bust affected our national psyche in some way?
I do. I think that it did encourage people to become entrepreneurs. And entrepreneurship comes from, you know, sometimes needing something different. And in times of recession, you see people start companies because maybe they've lost their jobs and they, you know, they have a great idea and it becomes an incredible idea. It's a time of opportunity in a lot of ways. But these things came to an end, but it doesn't mean great companies, great technologies weren't created.
So, Raul, if you don't mind my asking, what are you driving now?
What am I driving now? I'm driving whatever can fit three car seats for my kids. So, you know, the focus is on getting them to school every day, and it's a lot of fun. That's a new focus.
All right. Raul Fernandez is founder of ProxyCom. He's a co-owner of the Washington Capitals, Wizards, and Mystics. Shannon Henry is a former Washington Post columnist, and she's the author of The Dinner Club, a book about the D.C. area tech boom. She's the co-founder of the food site Cooking with Friends. They were both featured in a story about the tech boom in this week's Washington Post magazine. If you want to read that piece in its entirety, and I hope you will, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on programs, then on Tell Me More. Raul, Shannon, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
You may not recognize the name of Howard Bragman, but you certainly have heard of some of his clients, Chaz Bono, former basketball player John Amici, as well as Meredith Baxter and Isaiah Washington. Bragman represents all kinds of famous people, but he's also become one of the go-to public relations specialists for stars who want to come out of the closet while living in the limelight, as well as celebrities like Washington who have offended the gay community. He joins us now to talk about his work and his book, Where's My 15 Minutes? Get Your Company, Your Cause, or Yourself the Recognition You Deserve. And Howard Bragman joins us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. It's great to be here.
I think some people might question, is it really still a big deal for somebody to come out of the closet?
It really is still a big deal because, number one, there's a great deal of fear out there. Number two, I think we've lost almost every gay marriage vote that has ever been on the ballot. And so we still have a lot of hills to climb. So, yeah, it is a big deal. And it's particularly a big deal when you're an actor and when you're a public figure.
See, that's the part that I'm puzzled by. Why is it particularly a big deal if you're an actor?
Because actors get work on their ability to be whatever you want them to be. And as much as it pains me to say this, there's a huge double standard in Hollywood. Whereas Tom Hanks can play a gay man with a lot of credibility and win an Academy Award for it, God forbid they say, well, a gay guy's going to play a straight guy. Nobody's going to buy it. And that double standard exists, and we have to get beyond that. And I think we are in a lot of ways. My dear friend Cheyenne Jackson, who's a Broadway star and he's now on the show 30 Rock, is a very openly gay man and playing a very, very heterosexual man very effectively on 30 Rock. Neil Patrick Harris is doing the same thing. He's playing not just a heterosexual, but an aggressively heterosexual man on his show. It's things like that that are changing the dialogue and changing people's mindset, but we still have hurdles to overcome.
Is there a difference for men and women, do you think? Do you think
Absolutely.
That there's a different standard for men or for women?
In this male-dominated society, a lot of heterosexual males think, well, I think chicks are hot. I'm sure chicks think chicks are hot, too. And it's less of a hurdle to overcome, whereas the thought of two men isn't something that they may assimilate quite as well. That being said, I just worked with Meredith Baxter, who I took out of the closet, and that was quite a shocker, but again, met with a great deal of acceptance.
And what about the idea of sex reassignment? You recently advised Chaz Bono, who initially came out as a lesbian and then has undergone a medical process to transition to being a man. And I know she gave an interview on the Today Show.
He, forgive me.
Forgive me.
I do it sometimes, too, and okay. He smacks me in the arm.
Did that present special challenges, or was the Absolutely. Groundwork laid because Chaz was already a public figure in a certain
Well,
way?
The vast majority of people who go through gender transitions do it discreetly. It's a long process, and it's been described to me as akin to going through puberty because of the number of years it takes in terms of the hormone therapies, etc. Chaz recognized that, again, having been a public figure since his birth, he didn't have the option of doing it privately. Mm-hmm. So when he first mentioned to me that he was going to go through this transition, we recognized that he had a very important role because he was going to be the most famous person in the world ever to make this transition. And not only did we have to do it right, we had to do it in the public eye. Hmm. And it was tough. And it's sort of a step beyond taking people out of the closet.
That makes sense to me as you describe it from a representational standpoint, from a role model standpoint. But for what about other figures? Why do they feel they have to discuss these issues?
Everybody has a different reason. There was an NFL player I worked with named Asera Tuaolo. He wanted to live what he called his truth. John Amici had a book coming out. Meredith Baxter had just gone on a lesbian cruise, and the press started calling, so we realized this was going to get out there, and we had to get ahead of it. Everybody has their own very personal reasons, but in the end, most people want to live their truth, and they don't want people to make assumptions that are necessarily wrong.
What about people who are out of the limelight, as it were? I guess that's the part that I think is confusing. You can see where a sports figure in a very macho field like the NFL might hesitate for all kinds of reasons. But once he's retired, why is it our business?
You know, it's their business that they choose to do it. And I think in most cases of people I work with, their motivations were pure, that they wanted to advance the dialogue and show that the stereotypes that we have always associated are not accurate, and some of the most macho people in society are indeed gay, and they're living wonderful, productive, happy lives.
In fact, that NFL player who you were telling us about, I think you mentioned in your book that part of it, he and his partner were raising children together.
Exactly.
And he wanted to let people know that they were a functioning and healthy family, and he wanted to represent, as it were,
Well, he told me about the time he was on a trip with his husband and the kids, and, you know, he's mumbling about how to introduce that. You know, just being able to say, hey, this is my partner and these are our kids. These little things add up and they make a big difference in society.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Howard Brackman. He's one of Hollywood's best public relations experts, and he's the guy many stars go to when it comes to coming out of the closet. He's also the author of a book called Where's My 15 Minutes? Get Your Company, Your Cause, or Yourself the Recognition You Deserve. You are also openly gay. Have you?
Oh, my God. Now you've outed me.
I know. I've outed you. Well, it's in your book, so I figured it wasn't a secret.
Yes, I've been out for 30 years.
I was going to ask you, were you ever in the closet?
You know, I was dealing with it when I was in college, but as soon as I graduated from college and from my first job, I told my parents more than 30 years ago. And coming out of the closet is a metaphor for living an honest life. You may have to come out of the closet about the fact that Michael C. Hall did, the star of Dexter, recently talked about the fact that he had cancer.
Hmm.
Or you may want to talk about an illegitimate child, John Edwards. You may want to talk about quitting, getting fired, whatever it is. Understand it's only a metaphor at this point.
Sure, and I understand what you're saying. But to your point about some fields where your mutability is highly valued or we're not being perceived to have any particular allegiances, like journalism, for example, is highly valued, or in some branches of journalism, let's put it that way. Is there any right time to come out? Do you ever advise someone not to? Because you said, well, it's just at this stage of your career, not worth it.
I did. I had a former NFL player, and he wasn't ready in his mind. He hadn't told his parents. He hadn't told his employers. And I said, before you come out to the public, you have to do the foundation work of talking to your family, talking to your employers, and making sure that you're 100% comfortable, because once you flick that switch, there's no going back.
On the other side of the equation, you've represented some clients who are controversial in the LGBT community because they've been perceived as making offensive remarks or engaging in
offensive behavior.
Offensive behavior. I'm thinking of Isaiah Washington, who some people feel made disparaging comments toward gays. I don't know that he thinks he did. And then Doug Manchester, who's a hotel owner, who was one of the biggest contributors to Proposition 8. But you represented both of them. Talk to me about that.
You know, we are human beings. And by definition, human beings are screw-ups. And we are going to make mistakes. And in the case of Isaiah Washington, in the case of Doug Manchester, both of them have stood up and said, we made mistakes, we're going to make amends to correct these mistakes, and we're going to promise never to do it again, which both of them have done. And as soon as we are not willing to forgive people, we become, as a society and as a gay and lesbian community, something that's really not as attractive because, again, I see mistakes every day. I've made plenty of mistakes, but I really believe in the concept of true forgiveness for somebody who is truly contrite and acknowledges that they made a mistake.
Howard Brackman represents celebrities from all walks of life. His PR company is known as 15 Minutes. He's the author of a book called Where's My 15 Minutes? Get Your Company, Your Cause, or Yourself the Recognition You Deserve. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR West. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks,
Don't
Michelle.
Be a stranger. Appreciate we hope we talk to you again. I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, I share my thoughts about Women's History Month and other months. That's in just a few minutes. But first, Hollywood celebrated its own at the 82nd Annual Academy Awards last night. Joining me to recap the best and worst about the Oscars is Wesley Morris. He's the film critic for the Boston Globe, and Reginald Hudlin, a Hollywood producer, writer, director, and member of the Academy. I welcome you both. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you.
Hello, Michelle.
I know, late night for everybody. Try to try to perk up, right?
I'm awake.
You're energized. I'm glad to hear it. Well, let's start off by hearing a bit of Monique's acceptance speech after she was awarded the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. That, of course, for her role as the horrendous mother figure in Precious, the film after the novel Push by Sapphire. Here it is.
First, I would like to thank the Academy for showing that it can be about the performance and not the politics. I want to thank Miss Hattie McDaniel for enduring all that she had to so that I would not have to. Tyler Perry and Oprah Winfrey, because you touched it, the whole world saw it.
Well, first of all, Wesley, what's she talking about, the politics and not the performance? What's she talking about?
Well, Monique actually did a very unusual thing by Hollywood standards, which is that she decided not to campaign for an award. She didn't show up on the talk shows. She has her own show. She didn't cozy up to the Academy. She didn't do all kinds of magazine spreads and sort of talk about how much the Oscar meant to her. She really just stayed back. And I think that she got a lot of heat initially, and then it seemed to not affect her chances or her odds of winning other awards. And I think it became this very sort of controversial thing that worked out in her favor. And she's right. It should not be about having to campaign to win these things. You should either win because you were good or you lose. I mean, it should speak for itself. And I think that in her case, it worked.
Reginald, what about that? Is that the expectation that people will campaign for these things? I think she had a good argument. Number one, she has two little boys and she has two small children and she has a daily show. So I don't know how she would have figured, how she would have managed that. But Reginald, what about that? Was there some sort of negativity around her refusal to campaign?
Well, you know, the thing is whether there was negativity or not, I mean, you know, the fact is, you know, campaigning is dirty business, whether it's politics or even in the entertainment business. So people certainly seized upon that and tried to spin that perception of she's not really grateful because look at what she's not doing. So there was certainly an attempt, whether it was it certainly didn't seem to be an actual perception because she won pretty much everything that she was nominated for. But there was certainly an attempt to spin it as if there was grumbling, there was negativity. And she just kept on winning.
And Reginald, can I ask you about one other thing, speaking of sort of the politics of the award? She became the fifth African-American to win an Oscar, joining, of course, Hattie McDaniel, to whom she gave homage, and Whoopi Goldberg, Halle Berry, Jennifer Hudson. There, you know, there is some feeling, and I know it's being sort of talked about, particularly on Black Radio this morning, is, okay, she wins for playing an abusive mother. Hattie McDaniel plays for being a maid. Halle Berry plays a woman who's having sex with a man who's abused and killed her husband. What's up with all of that? Do you see where I'm standing with it? Some people say that's great that she won the award. A lot of people really respect and appreciate Monique, but that's what African-American women win for when Sandra Bullock wins for playing an uplifting, positive role.
Well, here's the reality is, you know, most women, for instance, there was a run a couple of years ago when women who played prostitutes kept winning Oscars. And this was not necessarily a Black thing. This was just women, and the parts they are offered, at least the juicy parts they are offered. It's become a long-running joke that if you want to win an Oscar, you have to play someone who's mentally incapacitated. So these kind of big, showy roles, which often you're playing an anti-hero, you're playing a villain. For example, the best supporting actor plays one of the most evil Nazis ever on screen. So, yes, you know, it's particularly frustrating for the Black community because we have such a desire to see the full range of our humanity. But the reality is, race aside, those kind of parts tend to be Oscar bait.
And speaking of Sandra Bullock, I mentioned how she won Best Actress for her role in The Blind Side. Wesley, we talked about this film earlier when you were on the program talking about looking ahead to the Oscars. And you said there were some feelings about the fact that first of all, the film made a lot of money. A lot of people enjoyed it. But there was a little bit of an ick factor in the sense that here's a woman who plays a role she's just like save the Black kid. And a lot of people are saying, what's up with that? And now that you've thought about it a little bit more and some time has passed, and she did give, I think, a lovely acceptance speech.
It was a great speech.
Where she gave a shout out to an appreciation for the mothers out there who take care of babies no matter who they are. Does that change your feelings about it at all?
No. No, I mean, you know, the thing about Sandra Bullock's performance in that movie is that it is separate from the movie's actual problem. I mean, yes, she's playing the woman who, the white woman who takes in this black kid. But the problem with the movie is not her character. It's the fact that the screenwriter and director, John Lee Hancock, didn't bother to make Michael Orr more of a character in the film. I mean, there's no, it's her movie, not his, but it's his story, not hers. It's a really interesting upending of I guess the ownership of this situation.
The black person is the object, not the subject. Once
right.
again,
I mean,
the done to rather than the doer.
Right. I mean, this is a vehicle for Sandra Bullock, not. You know, it's not an ensemble picture. It's a movie about how this woman basically molds this kid into a good football player and gives him a chance he wouldn't have had were it not for her.
Reggie, what do you feel about that? Did the film similarly push your buttons?
Well, you know, I think these things are really complicated. When I look at that movie, I go, I don't know. Is there a lot of difference between Precious and The Blind Side? There certainly are a lot of similarities. And, you know, there are people who object to both films. But, you know, The Blind Side has a black producer, a black filmmaker made Precious. And at the end of the day, I think there's something great about this woman helping this young black man. I think there's nothing wrong with celebrating it. Is there any, you know, is it comparable to Schindler's List, where you have a German who saves a bunch of Jews? I don't know.
Also based on historical reality.
Exactly. I mean, I don't, you know. You know, at the end of the day, this woman did a great thing, and at a certain point, you don't want to be a jerk and say, well, why couldn't it be a black person? Well, you know, sometimes black people save people, sometimes white people save people. I hear your point about wanting to see more of Michael Orr and fleshing him out, and I agree. I would have liked to known more about that character.
I think Wesley's point was that the sort of white folks being either redeemed by black people or saving black people is almost a trope.
It absolutely is.
And so
there's no doubt about it. There's a long tradition of, I mean, I remember being a kid and seeing Conrack and getting all choked up.
Conrack.
Okay.
So, I mean, yes, that tradition of, you know, people being transformed, you know, in both directions. And of course, you know, every once in a while we get the reverse. We get to serve with love and so on. So
that's true. That's true. Are the lilies of the field. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking Oscars with film critic Wesley Morris and producer Reginald Hudlin. And historic night, I think everybody can agree with that. Speaking of history, Barbara Streisand talked about how Lee Daniels was only the second African-American nominated for Best Director, Kathryn Bigelow, the first woman, and she won. She's the first woman to take home the statue for Best Director for The Hurt Locker. Of course, I'll just play a short clip of her talking about her win. Here it is.
This really is, there's no other way to describe it. It's the moment of a lifetime. First of all, this is so extraordinary to be in the company of such my fellow nominees, such powerful filmmakers who have inspired me and I have admired, for some of whom for decades. And thank you to every member of the Academy. This is, again, the moment of a lifetime.
You know, Reginald, what's interesting, she didn't really make any explicit reference to her gender or this being history-making in the way that, for example, Halle Berry did when she won, or in the way that Monique did when she won. Do you feel that her gender played a role in her victory? I mean, I think the critics raved about The Hurt Locker. It didn't make a lot of money, but I think most people who've seen it just thought it was an amazing film. But do you think that her gender played a role? And will her win play a role in opening up opportunities for other women in Hollywood?
Yes, I think her gender played a role, but that's okay. I mean, the fact is she made an amazing movie. It was interesting just being on a set and you talk to some of the below-the-line folks, the, you know, DPs and the grips and stuff like that. You know, there was a lot of love for The Hurt Locker because people looked at that film as a film with a lot of integrity. So I wasn't surprised to see the wins for her and the wins for the film. And also, I think the fact that she's a woman who has made a quote-unquote man's movie. I think the fact that she broke through doing what is not perceived as the kind of movies that women direct, I think gave her an extra boost. So does that make it easier or tougher on the next woman? I don't think it necessarily makes a difference. I think Hollywood, it's tough to make changes. I mean, black folks have been making quote-unquote breakthroughs for a long time, but at the end of the day, change is glacial.
And to that end, what about Gabourey Sidibe, the star of Precious, nominated for Best Actress? And, of course, she has an amazing story, too. Here's a girl who was a college student, tried out on a whim, got the part, and then is then, you know, sitting in the front row seat at the Oscars, and as I think has gotten a lot of attention, both for the strength of her performance and because she's an unusual leading lady in Hollywood, being of large size as well as dark skin. We might as well just say it. Does this open up other opportunities for women like her, do you think, Reggie? Based on your pressure, yeah. Based on what you just said, no.
The fact is, I don't think that she is unusual, but she isn't. I mean, you know, the fact is, not to diminish her extraordinary achievement, I think Oprah put it very well last night. Like, here you are, you are a college student, and now you're in the same category as Meryl Streep. That's an amazing, amazing story. But, you know, the fact is, whether you're talking Hattie McDaniel or Gabourey or Monique, I think, you know, a heavyset black woman actually has a better shot in Hollywood than a more conventional leading lady.
And finally, can I ask each of you what you thought about the program itself, the production itself, the Oscars as a show? Wesley, what do you think?
I thought it was long. It was 3 hours and 32 minutes. It felt like 6 hours and 64 minutes. I mean, that's actually 7 hours and 4 minutes. It's long. I don't really complain about the length of the show, but I think this year they really made a mistake. And I think that the mistake basically was to prepackage most of the show with these clip montages, which don't really work with a live program in the way that some of the other innovations they came up with last year, like having the nominees serenade each other, like having old winners serenade the current nominees, which they did in the latter half of the show, which actually picked up. It became a lot more of a live production as opposed to relying on these sort of pandering clip packages to horror movies, which made no sense since, you know, we don't expect that from
the
Academy Awards.
To the film students out there who've studied the rest of us are like, what? What is that?
Yeah, the John Hughes tribute, which was a relatively good idea, but I mean, he was never nominated for an Academy Award. And it was not like there was a lot of sort of trying to figure out who was going to watch the show once they got all these people in front of their TV sets. Who was actually there?
Welcome to programming, my dear. Welcome to programming.
Yeah, I mean,
okay, Reggie, sorry, quick. We only have 10 seconds. Thumbs up or thumbs down on the production. Did you like it? Didn't like it?
I thought it was I think they did very well considering. You know, the ugly truth is, unless they eliminate some of the categories that audiences don't care so much about, the show's always going to feel really long.
Okay. Long. It's long enough for me to get a sandwich. I was happy about that. All right. Here we go. Reginald Hudlin is a Hollywood producer, writer, and director. He's a voting member of the Academy. We're not going to ask him how he voted. He joined us from NPR West. Wesley Morris is a film critic for the Boston Globe, and he joined us from Boston. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Finally, a few words about Women's History Month. It started as International Women's Day, which is today. We'll be observing it with conversations that showcase interesting and hopefully unexpected takes on the role women have played in the life of this country, just as we did with Black History Month, which just ended, and as we plan to do with Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, which comes in May, and Hispanic Heritage and Native American Heritage Months, which come later in the year. Now, some people wonder why we have these so-called Heritage Months, and some take it even further to get all retro-racist about it. Black History Month seems to spark an especially egregious outpouring of stupidity. Cotton balls were sprinkled outside an academic building at one Midwestern campus last month, and of course you heard about the Compton Cookout on this program, which was an off-campus party held by a fraternity associated with the University of California at San Diego, where the white revelers were encouraged to act out as many racist stereotypes as they could fit in the course of getting their drink on. Okay, we get the point. You don't like black folks or assertive women or whoever. You think they're getting too big for their britches or are, as one student at UC San Diego put it, ungrateful. And he added the N-word for extra spice. Can I just tell you, it's the opposite. It is the speaker of those words who is ungrateful and ignorant. Too many people who no doubt think of themselves as well-informed are somehow unaware of or indifferent to the contributions of women and people of color to the progress and development of this country, which is why these Heritage Months exist to begin with. But even more egregious, it seems, as though too many people are willfully unaware, intentionally ignorant, or just refuse to acknowledge the truth. I'm reminded of this just about every time we post our blog or open the mail. One of the reasons I'm glad we have a blog is that the rest of the world can now be made aware of the kinds of things reporters, especially reporters of color, have known all along, which is just how many people out there cannot wrap their heads around the idea that people other than propertied white men have contributed anything significant to this country. The Pulitzer Prize winner Leonard Pitts wrote a column about an exchange he had with a reader who just denied that a Medal of Honor winner who was black had deserved it. Couldn't have happened, this reader insisted, because blacks weren't officially assigned to combat positions until years later, which is precisely the point. Just as women are in harm's way now, even if they aren't assigned such roles, it makes uncommon bravery that much more noteworthy. But this reader didn't want to hear all that. He just preferred to act as if these events never happened. There are all manner of historical deniers out there, of course. Now, most people don't spend too much time on them or prefer to assign them to the lunatic fringe. And the people who spend a lot of time challenging those views, well, don't we look a little askance at them, too? Don't we kind of smirk and say, well, nobody believes that nonsense, that women shouldn't lead, that blacks aren't smart, that Latinos and Asians and Native people are whatever. But evidently, some people do believe those things. New research shows that parents who refuse to talk about race are really just making it taboo. Now, I'm not naive enough to believe that if you present everybody with the same information, they'll come to the same conclusions. That's not the point. But those of us who believe that reality should have some meaning have to speak up. If we don't provide the information, we cannot reasonably argue that people should know it. And if the truth doesn't set you free, well, I don't know what will. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.